switching in. The U.S. go up. What a goal from Carlos Bocanegra.
Lloyd will try a long hit. What a goal from Lloyd. This is spectacular. It's hit with no regard for humanity. Is this the moment for Shaqiri? Yes, it is. Switzerland. And Shaqiri has scored in the 90th minute. That was worth the price of admission alone.
This is Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
Welcome into Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5, presented by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. 713 call now. This is our best of version, and tonight we take you back to some of our favorite interviews of the year 2023. We have proudly brought Soccer Talk to the radio in Houston since 2001. Let's get started. Well, Ben, first off, welcome to Houston.
Great to be here.
So let's just talk a little bit about how this came down and when you got the job offer and then how you accepted it.
Well, I think it was documented a little bit that flirted with the job earlier in the year. And I just didn't think it was the right time to put my name in the hat. And as the year went on, I was more convinced that it was time to get back into coaching. And but this was not something that I was out applying for every job that, or any job for that matter, that came up where a coach got let go and there was an opening. This was the only one. Part of that is because of Pat Onstead, and obviously we have a relationship, and I want to work with people I trust in this next phase of getting back into it. I had the itch to coach again and be back in the locker room, be back on the field, be back in the arena, so to speak. And as I went through the interview process, it became very clear that this was the place for me in this moment of my life. And fortunately, they thought the same thing. And so their vision was one that resonated with me. The challenge itself of a club that, I don't know if reboot's the word, but certainly needs some change. And it's going to take a little bit of time, but some of those building blocks that have already been laid, I'm seeing, and it's not always evident to the fans and on game days, especially when you're losing this year. But there's a lot happening at the facility, and people being brought in that I think are really sharp and are going to help turn this franchise around.
He's new Houston Dynamo head coach Ben Olsen joining us. Look, you know, all your years in D.C., we remember a lot that came out of there. Well, a lot of this comes back to us around the league and bannered around social media. But Ben Olsen didn't have enough resources in D.C. That's one we commonly heard. Is there something from those experiences you can take into this one?
Yeah, of course, right? I mean, when you coach for 10 years, in particular at D.C. United, I think I can take a lot from there. I don't want to get too much into what D.C. didn't give me. I view them as I'm still a real romantic with that club, and I feel really fortunate to have been there that long. At times I had a long leash. At times I think we punched above our weight. But really, it's just the reps of coaching and being in the locker room, working with different types of players, different types of teams, and getting those reps as a leader and figuring who I was as a coach leader that now I think I can draw back on to help me have success here. And it's one of the things, Glenn, that I wanted that drove me to take another job is I only know me in that atmosphere, right? This is new. This is new people. This is new fan base. People in Houston don't care who I am. I have no history here. So reinventing who I am as a coach, still using my past, is very exciting for me. with people that I trust, people with resources, and I think people that share a similar vision that I do.
As such a big figure in D.C., player, I mean, you were even in the Virginia area. I remember calling your games at UVA, coaching, playing at D.C. Is there a freshness, just to kind of jump onto that last point you made about coming to a fresh environment? Is that exciting for you? And I would have to think, in a way, you know, you segued yourself perfectly by saying you're in a little bit of a way, it's kind of anonymously coming into a very different market.
Both, yes, to answer your question, it's exciting both professionally and personally. You know, I have three kids, one in high school, a daughter in high school who's still wrapping her head around coming to Houston. I have two boys and a family. So this is a big move for us, again, professionally and also as a family, to take this adventure. And it's one that I think there will be a little bit of short-term pain, but long-term gain with the personal stuff, and you're showing, you know, seeing what I'm made of in a new environment, from a personal standpoint, what you know, a little adversity in the family of picking up where we're very comfortable in our DC bubble that we in a lot of ways had it all figured out. But I think that's important in life, to try something new.
Ben Olsen joining us. He's a new Houston Dynamo head coach, and pleased to have him on Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5, presented by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. I get the proactive side of it. We've heard that before. The fans have heard that before. We've heard the fiery. The fans have heard that before, and I'm not being crass here. It's just it's what they've heard. What additionally in the details has Pat talked to you about? Because I did hear you in the press conference talking about playing a more progressive pressing style of play, if I got that right, because my audio was not great.
You don't go from where we're at now to playing like Man City. We're playing like Liverpool. It takes time. So we have to build this to a game model. And this proactive style that Pat continues to talk about, it doesn't happen overnight, right? But it is important for us to strive for that and put in a structure and make sure the players are very clear in that structure on the field, so we can be a better team at root pressing. We can be a team that has more sustained possessions in the opponent's half, more chances, more service, right? A higher expectation of goals per game, right? This is the goal. This is not new. Every team wants this. Everybody wants to go and repress get expected goals that are, you know, 7 expected goals and win games 4-2 and entertain their fans, right? But there are steps, and you know me for a long time, and you know, I still believe in being pragmatic and defending and being gritty and being nasty and having a real spirit about your team that's hard to play against. But you can bring that into a game model that is a little bit more proactive than maybe I got pigeonholed in DC United as my way of playing, which again was extremely pragmatic, very defensive, more counterattacking game model. So that is not going to be the way we play. Hopefully these teams do not resemble the way we went about the game from a game model in DC United. So that will look different, and we will, but I'm saying that you don't get there overnight. This is going to be a process, and people don't want to hear that. And people don't want to say it's going to take time and patience. That's just the reality of digging out of a team that's been in the playoffs one time out of the last decade. So we got a lot of work to do. This roster will look a little bit different. We've got 6 to 10 new players potentially coming in. They're not going to be the high end DP players, as you know, but that doesn't mean you can't transform kind of the makeup of the group and enhance the roster with TAM players, college draft picks, high college draft picks, and players within the league that I think are good cultural pieces and winners.
Ben is changing this into a type of team like that. In addition to you being here and your leadership as a head coach, does that include adding more creative players to this team? And I would just say about the fiery remark, yeah, I got to say LAFC's got to be pretty fiery. They don't win an MLS Cup, right? Isn't that a prerequisite?
If you saw the final game, it was a street fight. I mean, it was two extremely athletic, physical teams. And it's no surprise that they were, and both of them were extremely well-rounded. They weren't all attack or all defense. They were adaptable. They were two of the best teams on the defensive end, and they scored a bunch of goals. So they were complete, and they could win games in different ways. So that, you know, this, you know, I don't, let's not get too caught up in this proactive, like, fly by the seat of your pants type structure and game model, right? It still has to make sense. And it's going to change when we play LAFC. It's going to change to when we play maybe at home on a Wednesday night where we want to push the game against a team that may be tired. So, but giving them something to fall back on a structure and principles of play and where we want to be, I think helps the players, helps our fans identify who we are and how we're going to go about the game.
So what was it like coaching Wayne Rooney in Houston? Now that you have a Hector Herrera here, was that a challenge as a coach? What did you learn from that? You know, because that's a global icon, right?
Yeah. I was excited when I found out that Wayne was coming because I really wanted to have that experience as a coach and deal with a guy that is on that level of fame and importance in the soccer world. Hector has a lot of those qualities in that he's a star. He's a big name. He's played at the highest levels. He's a world-class player. So I can't wait to get to know him and to sit with him and bring him into a part of our decision-making. That's what I did with Wayne and not just the stars, but people that have been around and have had great experiences within the game. It'd be silly not to bring them into the fold, to create buy-in and he's going to be a huge part of it. I don't look too much into this year, some nagging injuries, the World Cup on the horizon. It's always a tough time to be at their best. So I'm going to be relying heavily on him, whether it's leadership, on the field presence, and just being, you know, one of our best players week in, week out.
Ben Olson, new Houston Dynamo head coach in Houston. We are thankful for his time here, presented by the Daspit Law Firm. So Ben, you know, from the outside, how much have you watched Houston in the last year or last 2 years? How much of that story do you know, and kind of what do you see through your lens?
I know him pretty well. I've watched most games, and I'm pretty familiar with the roster. My sense is there's a good core, but the roster needs bolstered. I think there's areas of concern that we need to fill profiles. I think we can get a little bit tougher. I think we can get a little bit faster. I think the creativity can be enhanced. I think the structure itself, I think we could be a little clearer on who we are, game in, game out. Of course, again, it's always going to adapt. And there's going to be times you need to grind, and there's times where you need to push the gas and play on the front foot. So, but again, making sure they're clear on this game model and the adaptations off of that is good. We're going to spend a lot of time on that over the next few months until the first game. But there's a lot there. I don't mean to go negative on it. There's a lot there, and there's a lot of players that are willing to work their tails off for the club. There's high end talent. Big fan of Carrasquilla, obviously Herrera. You have a goal scorer, a proven goal scorer, which is hard to get in this league. I mean, 15 goals in a season like they had, not too shabby. And that's without, you know, a high end of box occupation and low level of service, low quantity of service. and at times low quality of service, right? Let's face it. But I don't want to get too much into that team, and because I know it's hard to be a coach, and sometimes I do that. It looks like I'm throwing coaches under the bus, and it's a tough job. And Paulo coming in to a new team and a transition, and having the group he had, that's not an easy task. So I certainly feel for the circumstances that he went through this year.
Ben, I appreciate that honesty, and I think the listeners will as well. I just want to take you back to Sebas Ferreira, and I'm not going to get too heavy into the roster with you. We got to give you a chance to get acclimated here. But I do want to talk about a goal scorer who could be the difference in games, probably could have been the difference in another 3 to 4 games, another 12 points. Is it going to be important to surround him with some more penetrators, some more creativity? And Eddie Robinson and I on the broadcast always say this guy can be a 15 to 20 goal scorer in this league, no question.
Yes, to answer your question, having a creative influence on the field, I think if you know me and you've seen my teams over the years, there's more times than not a 10 out there and someone that can now provide be unpredictable and have eyes that are just a little bit different than a lot of the players out there. Hector has some of those qualities, but really it's still about finding where Hector makes us tick the most and where he feels most comfortable. And that's one of the big dominoes that we have to figure out what structure and where can we make sure he's very successful in. Within that, yes, finding someone who is an attacking-minded playmaker. But, you know, playmakers are not always the Marco Echeverries of the world. There's 9.5s out there. There's forwards that come back into the pocket and feel comfortable that can still play a pass. So there's different types that we're looking for in that area within the structure that we have in our minds and our game model right now. So over the course of the next 3 weeks to probably 2 months, we've identified some good players in those spots, in a bunch of different spots of areas that need. And I look forward to getting in the room with everybody and finding which guys we think can take us to the next level. But Sebas, there's more to him too. To go back to your question there, it's important to score goals, and 15 is again not too shabby, and we can push that higher. But now there's all these other things that we're going to be asking him to do on the defensive end, within buildup, how he connects the game, and how he's a handful for any center backs that want to play against him, that they know they're in for a long night, other than some of the goals. So we're going to push him. We're going to push every player to see what we can get out of him.
You alluded to the Houston soccer community and this team in the playoffs once in a decade, and you do seem to be very up on how beaten down this franchise has been. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but it's a reality. I lived here. I've lived it. The culture and all of that, you're only one man. Pat's only one man. Outside of just winning and the on-field competitive product getting better, what are other things that you see, maybe big picture, to expand the relevancy of this team and the authenticity of it, maybe the authentic soccer side of it? Because this town, like DC, is full of authentic soccer fans that aren't coming to the party.
I love that word. Authenticity is how I try to live my life. But I'm not a magic bullet here, as you know. It takes so much more than a head coach coming in and, shaking things up and giving them a game model. I need people around me. I've been assured that there will be support around me to make myself whole and the staff. I guess one of the questions where you can add other than money for players, of course, money for players always helps and getting the best players possible. But there's an infrastructure piece here that's real, that can be enhanced. There's a staffing part that, when I talk about staffing, some of this is already in place and the fans don't necessarily see some of these people that are coming in that are sharp and good and experienced. And we're going to add more to that. on the technical side to make sure we have all the resources behind the scenes to put this team in a situation to have success. There's some stadium, the revamping the stadium, and the optics of that, I think, is important. The training facility, there's going to be some improvements there to give us a little bit more of a professional environment that goes a long way in my mind to digging out of this and expectations of coming into a workplace or a stadium that's is top class. All that stuff to me goes into this. So it's not just the players and how we connect to the fans. I'm not sure. I don't know that other than win and put a product out there that they're proud of and that resonates with them and the culture that is here in Houston. Other than that, I got to find that out a little bit. I'm new here, so I don't necessarily, I'm not pretending to know this city. I like it so far, but more times than not, I left here very unhappy because I just got my ass kicked, and it was. And I look forward to that now that I'm in charge here.
Ben, I want to thank you very much for your time. I know you're a very busy man here today. We appreciate it. You to get this out to my listeners for sure is awesome, and thank you very much for your time. We're going to wish you the best of luck, and I hope this is the first of many visits.
I look forward to catching up. Thanks, Glenn.
All right. That's the one and only Ben Olsen. He is the new Houston Dynamo head coach. All right. Welcome back to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5, as always presented by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. Hey, look, you get in a car, boat, motorcycle accident. You need the best when it comes to a personal injury attorney. It's John Daspit. It's the Daspit Law Firm. 713, call now or contact them at DaspitLaw.com. And we thank them for bringing soccer to the airwaves and on the radio for so many years. And speaking of a guy who's seen the game through a very different lens, our next guest, he's a writer. He's an award-winning writer. His name is Charles Coutone. He is, for me, one of the gatekeepers of the game in the United States. He has just completed a book called, it is called Pelé, His North American Years, A Tribute. And Charles joins us now. Charles, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
All right. I love the title already. I'm going to hit you with the title. Pelé, His North American Years. And I get the sense this book covers it better than anybody's ever done it. But then there is A Tribute. Tell me why you put A Tribute.
Well, because we kind of looked at this, I really wanted to look at this from the lens of when I first met Pelé, which I was a 13-year-old kid working in the Cosmos front office. And honestly, then I didn't really know much about soccer. When he came here, it was such a special time. It was a special time for the sport. It was a special time for me in my life. Kind of growing up really through my high school years, working for the team, being around Pelé, being around all the great stars that we had. And when George Tiedemann came to me with the idea for the book, we were trying to find a more traditional publisher without having much luck. I decided, my company would go ahead and do it. And it was just right after Pelé had passed away. So we just felt that was something that was necessary. And I think, with all the success that MLS has had, I think a lot of people kind of forget where those seeds were planted. It wasn't in 96 with the league starting. It wasn't in 94 with the World Cup being here. It was in 1975 when he first stepped out of a helicopter onto Randall's Island to look at what he was getting himself into.
He's Charles Coutone, writer of the new book. It's called Pelé, His North American Years, A Tribute. And looking at a lot of the excerpts, and I'm going to need my copy, Charles, for my coffee table.
Absolutely.
But looking at the excerpts, you do this in a much more detailed way through your lens than others, I think.
Well, I think part of it comes from the perspective of being there. Just looked specifically at those 3 years, that time here in North America, the growth of the sport that happened in those 3 years. It's never been looked at from that perspective. And that's what I tried to do in the words and wrapping those around George's tremendous pictures, because it's really the pictures that kind of tell the whole story.
Yeah, it's George Tiedemann, the photographer. You know, I often think of Pelé, and I've said this on the radio show before, you know, this was at a time when there wasn't player movement. People weren't trying to get to Europe and play in different places. So if you were lucky enough to be like us in the New York metropolitan area, we probably got to see Pelé play the game live outside of Santos in Brazil or at World Cups more than anybody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, his team Santos was very busy making tours because they were cashing in on his fame and his skill. So he did play some in the U.S. before. And I think that kind of planted the seeds for why people wanted to see him once he came to play here. And you're right about the movement to Europe. It was very, very rare at the time that players from South America or anywhere went to play, or even that players in Europe moved from one country to another. If you look at most of the rosters of top flight teams from that era, you know, all the English teams were probably 99% UK players. All the Italian teams were all Italian. So you really didn't have that a global sport.
Charles, talk to us about the acceleration. I mean, Pelé comes here. He plays in three different stadiums, Downing Stadium on Randall's Island, Yankee Stadium. And then this short amount of time, all of a sudden you're getting these massive crowds at Giant Stadium. These were games me and my buddies went to as kids. And now we had a standard of, hey, maybe one day we can be one of the American players in this league. But just speak to that acceleration about once he came here and just how this team went from playing on a dirt field and a field strewn with grass with the world's greatest player to all of a sudden being in Giant Stadium to packed houses and crowds that included Mick Jagger and Robert Plant.
Well, I think when Clive Toy was pursuing Pelé, he had an idea in mind that Giant Stadium was going to open in 1977. And when Pelé first agreed to play for the Cosmos, he told Clive initially 2 years. And Clive said, no, it's got to be three because the new stadium is going to open. And that's where you have to be. And we, you know, in 1975, we couldn't even really look that far ahead. We had a very small office staff, maybe five or six people. They hired a marketing director right around the time that Pelé was signed, and he didn't even have an office. He sat at the coffee table and the couch in the reception area. That's how just where we went. We went from that to, at the end of that season, moving into half a floor in the Warner Communications building in Rockefeller Center. I mean, that was really going uptown at that, better than playing in Randall's Island, where we actually did paint the dirt green for Pelé's first game.
I remember that game distinctively, and there was an overpass, right? And people were stopping on the overpass in their cars and standing along the railing.
Yeah, the stadium was under the Triborough Bridge. So yeah, that generated some crowds up there for not only that game, but the rest of the season.
He's Charles Cotone. The book is Pelé, His North American Years. Charles, quickly, where can people get the book?
Pretty much anywhere you can buy books. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, local bookstores. If they don't have it in stock, it's in their systems so they can get it. You know, that's where we're encouraging people to go, your local bookstore, support local businesses, especially now with the holidays coming up. But pretty much anywhere you can buy a book.
All right. I got a Barnes & Noble's right around the corner. I'm going to go there and get my copy there.
Great.
Charles Cotone, it's Pelé, His North American Years, a tribute. I'm sure when I read this fully, this is going to bring back a tremendous amount of memories of me and my buddies driving in the car from the suburbs to Giant Stadium to see Pelé. I saw him at Randall's Island, and I also saw him at Yankee Stadium. But, you know, I think people reflecting on the past don't realize that the game was not in the suburbs then. I was only fortunate that I had a coach come from Kearny, New Jersey, and train us every day of the week. But the game was not in the suburbs. It was in ethnic areas around cities at those times.
It was. And to a large degree, that made it almost invisible. I mean, the media didn't really cover the sport. The NASL was starting to grow a little bit on the West Coast. The markets like San Jose and Seattle had come in and were having some success there, which was really at that point where the core of a lot of the youth soccer was going on out on the West Coast. And I think a telling statistic that I found actually after I finished the book, but when Pelé got here, there were only about 100,000 registered players with U.S. soccer. By 1980, less than 5 years later, it was over a million. That just, you know, he sparked that growth. Like you said, you know, kids like you, kids like Brandy Chastain, Tony Meola, John Harkes, Tab Ramos, young kids seeing, you know, seeing this and seeing that, hey, there's a possibility in this game.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard data, too. That is pretty incredible. He's Charles Cotone again. It's Pelé, his North American years, a tribute. You know, you were around the man. I was at a press conference here in Houston once when we played him. We played against San Jose, and I think it was a UNICEF match. There was all these events going on, and Pelé was brought in, and we were in a press conference, and we got a little bit close to him. The magnetism, the smile, you having been close to him, tell me about the things that you liked about him, the qualities, what aura he carried.
He was a superstar who didn't act like it. You know, he treated people like they were important, like they meant something to him, because they did. He truly liked people. He liked being around people. I mean, there were so many times, you know, after games, especially on the road, it was tougher at Giant Stadium because we had that 10-foot wall around the field. But in places like Rochester, where there was a 3-foot high fence and the fans could just crowd along there, security had to hustle him away from, you know, to get him to stop signing autographs so we could get on the bus to get back to the hotel or get to the airport. Or he would have stayed there all night until every fan in that stadium had an autograph or had a chance to take a picture or shake hands with him. And that's just so very rare among, you know, athletes anywhere. I've been around all kinds of sports my whole life, and you don't see somebody with that kind of charisma, that magnetism, but yet that humbleness that, you know, he remembers where he came from. You know, he was born very poor in Brazil. And, you know, while he, you know, rubbed elbows with kings and presidents and popes, he still very much had time for.
This is Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
Thank you for tuning in to Soccer Matters tonight on ESPN 97.5, presented by the Daspit Law Firm. From me, Glenn Davis, to you, the passionate soccer fan, a huge thank you over the years for the support of this show. Thank you this year to our great passionate producers, Andrew Carlson, an unabashed Arsenal fan, B-Mac, Brian McDonald, and our current producer, lover of Barcelona, Guillermo Lazo Romero. These three gentlemen made it happen and make it happen. Podcasts at your favorite spots include Spotify, Google, Apple, and of course, ESPN975.com. Hit us up on YouTube. Soccer Matters, that's our channel. You can get all the interviews, all the shows there, and follow me on X, Facebook, at Glenn Davis Soc, at Soccer Matters GD, or head over to learn more about the host of this show at glenndavissoccer.com. On behalf of the Daspit Law Firm, our passionate presenting sponsor, I'm Glenn Davis. Thank you for tuning in, and remember, soccer matters.
Charles, did you have the sense that he knew he was there breaking virgin territory when it came to the sport? Did he really realize that this was an opportunity to grow a game in a place where it wasn't popular?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That was part of the mission. It wasn't to come here and win a championship, really, although that was important. I think that was important to all the other players on the team in 1977 that they send Pelé out with a championship. But he'd won everything. He'd won three World Cups. He'd won club championships. They beat Benfica in the World Cup club championship in 63. And I think Real Madrid in another one. But it wasn't about that. And he knew that. I mean, he did the press conferences. He did the interviews. He did all of the things that he needed to do. I mean, every road game, there was a press conference 2 days or a day before the game in whatever city we went to. And that was just Pelé. It wasn't a team thing. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like they do now, a 20-minute media op. It was a press conference. And if there were 50 people there and 50 people wanted to ask a question, he answered 50 questions.
Charles Catone, it's Pelé, his North American soccer years. His North American years, a tribute. By the way, this would be a great Christmas present. I'm gonna get myself a Christmas present today, Charles. I'm gonna go get the book on my own.
Great, thanks.
Charles has been a fantastic writer for the game. Obviously, you're hearing also through the lens of him as being in the PR department of the New York Cosmos. He's been involved in the game for over 50 years. And as he mentioned, George Tiedemann did a lot of the photos in this book. So you're going to see stuff that's just iconic and historic. Okay, so huge crowds accelerating the game by 77. But the NASL ultimately doesn't make it. It didn't have the support of the grassroots game yet. It wasn't there like it is now in Major League Soccer. What's the takeaway from it? And would we even be here without it?
I don't think we would be. I don't think we would be. There's an old Italian adage loosely translated, he who plants the olive tree never eats its fruit. And I think that's a good analogy to hear. Those seeds were planted in 1975 in that painted dirt. And it is taken until now. There were some people that were in the NASL that were involved in starting MLS, like Lamar Hunt, and a lot of people along the way who played a huge role in getting it to where it is. But I think you can, even though the history of soccer is really a chopped up line, unlike other sports where, you know, you can look at football and go back to the very first game and you know, the big events, and it's been fairly consistent. The history of soccer has been chopped up, but if you really look at where it started and what the timeline was, the idea for hosting a World Cup was planted in the NASL. We bid for the World Cup in 86 when they had to move it out of Colombia and didn't get it. And that was really the first seeds to, you know, where we are now, because in 88, when we bid, we did get it. And the reason that we got it was because FIFA looked and said, well, this is a country that has drawn 70,000 people for a soccer game. They know how to put people in the stadiums for soccer. And that all happened on the back of what Pelé and the Cosmos and the NASL did.
Pelé and the Cosmos hooked a lot of non-soccer people, too. I think we sometimes forget that. Yes, a lot of the game is learned and has been learned generationally through kids playing, and parents that didn't play have come to love the game. But Pelé also introduced the game to a lot of people that really had no interest in it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm thinking back to the Cosmos time kids that I went to school with were looking for tickets, and by 77, I mean, in 75, before Pelé got here, I couldn't give them away. In 77, people I hadn't seen in a couple of years or whatever were calling me and can you get me tickets for the playoff game? I'd like to go to the farewell game. And these were not people that had an interest in soccer. And I think it again, that idea that, you know, there was a superstar and his magnetism and his skill. It certainly wasn't where it was in the 1970 World Cup, but I would still say that when he got here by 1976, 75 was a bit of a rough season. He had an injury very similar to Messi coming, and he only played a handful of league games, and he had an injury. But by 76, he was really starting to show the skill again that was there and clicking better with the team. And I would say at that time, he was still one of the best players in the world. Absolutely. Even at, I think, 36 or 37.
He's Charles Cotone. Pelé is his book, His North American Years, a tribute. Part of me tells me you wrote this book because you still want people to realize something came before them. I because of the digital world and technology, everything's about quick hits now. But people forget how we got to this point, how we have been provided opportunity, how the sport has been provided opportunity. So part of me tells me there's a piece of you that wants to kind of subtly remind people about how we got to this point.
Absolutely. And you know, I love the history of the game, and it certainly goes back even before Pelé coming here. And some of the work that I'm doing now with U.S. soccer on Open Cup history and going back into the 20s, 30s, and 40s with some of the stories I'm doing for them. But writing the stories and some of the things and the way I wrote them were to remind people of that we didn't start in 1996. We didn't start in 1994 with the World Cup. And certainly we didn't start in 1975, but really I think that was what you could call, and one of the chapters in the book is soccer's big bang. And that's what it was. And I think if you look at almost every sport that has attained a certain level, it's had that kind of big bang. I mean, in the NFL, they always talk about that great championship game in 1958, you know, the NBA, it was the Bird Magic years. So every sport that has gotten to a certain level has had that big bang, and Pelé coming here and generating those crowds and winning the championship. And that was something the scriptwriters at Warner couldn't have done a better job at doing that ending, especially since the team was struggling mid-season.
Charles Cotone joining us. So, Charles, you know, you have Pelé, you had the watershed moment of David Beckham. Now we have Lionel Messi. These are probably the three-pronged attack historically of megastars that have come to America. As far as drawing direct parallels to any of this, I guess I'll go to Messi because there was a pursuit of him from Inter Miami, obviously, for a couple of years.
Right.
Same thing with Clive Toy going after Pelé. What sort of parallels do you draw?
Well, obviously, the biggest parallel is, I mean, it, in my mind, no one, Pelé will always be number one. But that's the biggest thing. But if you really, you look at where the game is now, Messi comes to MLS and the Chicago Fire draw 60,000 when he's expected to play there. Or Charlotte draws 66,000 for the last game of the season. That wasn't the first time MLS had drawn crowds of 60,000. That wasn't the first time Charlotte filled their stadium. There's going to be a bump to the league, but I don't think it's comparable that there's that next level that we're going to. It's not going to be, I think the big thing for the league is maybe the television viewers. I saw something the other day where that they said that the viewership for Apple games that Messi was playing in was about a million. So that's certainly a great number. And if his being here helps generate the TV numbers, that the league needs, then that's great. But I don't think anybody's surprised that 60,000 people were in Soldier Field. How many games have we seen at Soldier Field with 60,000 people there? that wasn't the case in 1976 and 77 when this started happening, because it wasn't just Giant Stadium where the team was filling games. I mean, the first game that was played in the Kingdome, 58,000 people, 40 something in Tampa, over 30 in RFK Stadium. The league was setting new attendance records, but we will see, I think, a growth in interest in the game overall. I mean, the jerseys are flying off the shelf. People are watching on TV. They're selling tickets. People are, you know, teams are now baking that game into ticket packages for next year. So, you know, if you want that game, you've got to either buy a season ticket or other tickets. So it's going to be good for MLS and the sport, but I don't think it's a seminal change in the sport. It moves us up another level, but how big a jump that is, I don't think it's the same.
Charles, congratulations on the book. It's called Pelé is North American Years, a tribute. Thank you very much for coming on the show tonight. I know my
thank little you, Glenn.
Will love this. A happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Thank you. Same to you.
And we look forward to talking to you
again.
Enjoy
doing it.
All right. That's Charles Cotone. It's Pelé, his North American Years, a tribute. It's a great book. Get it. That'll wrap it up tonight here for Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5, presented by Daspit Law Firm. It's daspitlaw.com. 713-CALL now. By the way, subscribe to the show. It helps us on the podcast after the fact of live radio at Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever. You can also get things at ESPN975.com. Of course, a big thank you as always to Lamont Brands. That's where you get the Soccer Matters t-shirts and hats. All the proceeds to the 501c charity, the Snowdrop Foundation. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.